Welcome to the Farcast, bringing you insights into Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thanks so much for joining us again this week. It is the 18th day of April. The stock market has been pulling back this month. 18 days of pullback means a negative 4.7%. And you probably have a little bit of a negative balance in your accounts after Monday, April 15th, and checks sent out to the IRS. The government's getting its money. We hope you're getting yours. But it is in your past, as they said in The Lion King, put your behind in your past and move ahead. So that's what we're going to try and do here on the Farcast as we look at markets, the economy, cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Once again this week, Jim Labenthal is going to start, Dan Mahaffey, and then Jenny Harrington, who takes an income approach to investing. It's been her business has been very successful, and she's one of the brightest people I get to talk to. So interested in hear what she says, given Jay Powell says he might not cut rates anytime soon. See what she says about that. So S&P has fallen 250 points or 4.7% this month. With the Fed staying on hold, markets have been disappointed. Look, pullbacks are healthy, and this one may have more to go. Longer term, I think either the economy continues to improve and stocks will do well longer term, or the economy starts to flag and then the Fed steps in and starts to ease rates, and markets probably go higher on that news too. So longer term, intermediate term is still pretty positive. We might go through more of this little bit of kind of a correction. My big concern is the rise in the Treasury yields. I think that the canary in the coal mine truly is gold. It's gone above $2,400 an ounce. It's been really on a rise after being stagnant for a long time in the $1,750 to $1,800 range. And all of a sudden, boom, it's taking off. Why? Jack Barugian suggests because the Fed might be losing hold of the long end of the curve. Long end of the curve is very important. That money, long-term money, gets expensive. Finally, I continue to harp on this, folks, and people want to say, just dismiss it, but the unstoppable increase in the debt is unsustainable. And it'll eventually be crippling if we can't turn this around. Congress and markets are whistling past the graveyard. Solid balance sheets, earnings growth are the keys. So don't be afraid to take some profits. And there's an old saying, sell in May and go away. With a political season, with Iran, with Iraq, and everything else, and you've got a bunch of profits in your portfolio, boy, I wouldn't be afraid to take some, book some. Don't fight the Fed. You're not going to win that. Joining me now, Jim Labenthal from Cerity Partners, CNBC contributor, and my great friend. Welcome, Jim.
Michael, good to see you. Good to be on with you. How are you?
I'm doing just great, thank you, here in April. My taxes are paid. I'm licking my wounds. I'm still walking with a limp. But, you know, most years it goes away by about September when I start thinking about next year's taxes. How are you, Jim?
I'm actually pretty good. I mean, I feel good, Michael.
Why is Wapner picking on you all the time? Why does Wapner pick on you on that show all the time?
In all seriousness, he holds me to a very high standard. And I like that. You know, whether he holds me to a different standard than anyone else is for others to determine. But he holds me to a high standard. He has high expectations for me. And I like that. That's a sign of respect.
I'll go with that. Well, it's a respect you've earned because you've leaned into the gale force winds and you have been correct over time and you've stuck with a discipline. And ladies and gentlemen, if you've heard anything over of the Farcast, it's to have a discipline, a dispassionate discipline, and stick to it. And as long as it's a cogent discipline, you will do well over time. Look, there are small cap growth managers and large cap value managers that will make money over time if they stick to their discipline. But when they start to trail, if they get emotional, or if they start to chase things, or if they have style drift, they will lose. Haven't heard Labenthal do that, and it's one of the reasons I also have great respect for you, Jim. What you heard me talk about markets, and you heard me talk about the debt with debt service next year looks like it could be larger than the Defense Department budget, which just scares the hell out of me. And we blithely continue to add $1.5 trillion more debt every year while the debt, you know, we can't pay the interest that we've got by it without borrowing more money.
That was an excellent fusillade of facts. But I want to go back to where you started, which was the opinion that discipline is a vital trait in investing. And I agree, right up there with patience. But let's talk about discipline, because over the last few weeks, maybe a couple of months, many people like us have said, hey, this market's run too far, too fast. It's due for a correction or at least a pullback. It could happen at any time.
We've said it a bunch right here. You and I and other guests consistently were due for a pullback.
Right. We're right here on the forecast. And you know, that conversation, at least from my lips, has taken the form of don't freak out. Have your discipline. When the market turns down, be prepared. And that means maybe trim a few names ahead of time. I know we've spoken about that in past few weeks.
Yes.
Trim a few names ahead of time so you've got some dry powder to deploy. And when the market comes down and those stocks that you've been waiting to buy come down with the market, do not freak out. Calmly, with a firm grip and a steely gaze in your eye, step into the fray and buy those stocks. Because, folks, nothing's changed. Okay, 10 years gone up. Got it. Maybe the Fed's going to be a little longer before they cut rates. Got it. Neither of those are fatal conditions for the stock market. Not when you've got the economy here in the U.S. growing at 2.9% as per the last Atlanta Fed GDP estimate.
Is that amazing, Jim? 2.9% on the day. Okay, so maybe it's 2.6%, but who cares? GDP, this was the year of the recession, and all of a sudden they're increasing GDP growth estimates again.
So, yes, it's amazing, but put that amazement aside. It's just a fact. It's just what's happening. And for those people, there are still several of them who say, well, just you wait, because those long and lagged effects of the Fed rate hikes are going to happen. You know, here's what I say to that. The last rate hike was 9 months ago. And, you know, the last two rate hikes were a total of 50 basis points over about 4 months. I mean, it was really at the end of 2022 that the bulk of the Fed's heavy lifting had been done. And here we are in the second quarter of 2024. Folks, if the long and lagged effects of the Fed were going to happen, they would have already happened. So everybody, take a deep cleansing breath and realize that the 10-year at 460 or 450 is not a fatal condition. If the Fed cuts in September instead of June, that's not a fatal condition. You've got a strong labor market. You've got a growing economy. You've got profits growing nicely. And things look actually pretty good. Now, Michael, I'm going to jump ahead of you here. You would say, okay, well, Jimmy, you always seem so calm and optimistic. What would turn you? What would turn you to pessimistic? I've been vocal in saying that if and when the Federal Reserve pivots back to rate hikes, that's when we've got to change our tune. That's where we've got to get more defensive, maybe put more consumer staples and utilities in your portfolio. But folks, that's not right now. 2 days ago, Jay Powell spoke, and yes, he pushed off rate cuts, but he's still talking about rate cuts. We're in a pretty good situation right now.
Okay, so we've pushed it off. Things look stable to you there for the Fed. What about the international situation, Jim? How do you process all this news? How do you process the news from Washington where Speaker Mike Johnson might lose his job because he won't be radical enough? And how do you process, you know, even the warnings and the rhetoric between Israel and Iran and what else could happen there? I mean, Iran has made very severe threats. And then all I'm thinking is you just fired a whole bunch of missiles and a whole bunch of drones and you hit diddly squat. Why are we scared of you beating your chest if we're Israel right now? You didn't lay a finger on us. I mean, but that just made me feel happy, by the way. Made me feel happy to see Iran do that. And made me happy just to be able to say that on the forecast. But these are some serious events around the world that can disrupt oil prices and commerce and shipping lanes and other things and add to costs and add to inflation. And in D.C., when we completely become dysfunctional and we don't support the rest of the world, those often fester and metastasize into far greater problems for us to deal with in the future.
So a lot to unpack there. Why don't we start with inside the Beltway? Okay, Speaker Johnson is doing what needs to be done, and he may be sacrificed on the altar of the radical right. Okay, you know what? He's doing the right thing. He's doing what needs to be done. The Republican Party, of which I am a member, is really quite dysfunctional at the current time. This happens. Both parties go through periods of dysfunction, and then they get their act together. I think the coming election will be a moment where the Republican Party can choose if it wants to continue, if the electorate wants to continue on this path of dysfunction. I know I don't, and I know how I will vote accordingly. Having said that, you know, that's just one part of the puzzle. I think aid for Ukraine and Israel is correct. I think we have an opportunity and a necessity to fight dictators and cruelty wherever we see it, and especially doing so overseas limits the possibility that we have to do it on home shores. Now, having said that, Michael, we are an investment discussion here. I don't mean to go too philosophical here. You know, in terms of what this means for the markets, geopolitical conflict is always there. It's always there. Middle East conflict is not something new, folks. You know that. Changing your investment stance because of hostilities anywhere in the world has, in the course of my lifetime, been a foolish move to make. Now, I'm not denying that there is a Rubicon that's been crossed with regards to Iran firing missiles. There has also been exit ramps displayed publicly for both Israel and Iran to choose to take. And Israel's allies are saying, don't escalate this. Don't escalate this. You got the win. Just take it easy now. I don't know how that will play out. You've got others who will come on who will give better insights into international politics. But what I will say as an investor is what's going on does not change my stance. As far as higher oil or, you know, higher freight prices because of missile attacks in the Red Sea, that happens. These prices go up and then they come down. That's just history, folks. There's no permanency to these effects on commodities, on shipping prices. They come back down. And if you look at freight capacity globally, there's a glut. There's a glut in freight capacity. You don't want to be a shipper of anything right now. Your profit margins stink. That's good for us as consumers. That's good for retailers. That's good for profit margins throughout the economy. So look through what the headlines in the newspaper are telling you.
Jim Labenthal is a partner at Cerity Partners, CNBC contributor, my great friend. Thank you, Jim. Always learn so much.
Oh, boy. And we had so much to cover. I thank you for taking the time with me.
We covered a lot, and you gave us a lot of information, a lot to think about. We're going to be right back with Dan Mahaffey and talk about D.C. Oh, my goodness. What will we ever find to talk about? Please stay with us.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Farcast. Now it's time for political analyst Dan Mahaffey and your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back to the Farcast. I'm Michael Farr. Joining me now, as he does every week, Dan Mahaffey, who has not changed, but his titles have changed. He is now vice chairman of the Dr. Scholl Foundation, still with the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. And of course, that one title of which he is most proud, senior political analyst on the Farcast. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you, Michael. Great to be talking with you.
We're very happy you're here. Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House of the United States, third in line in the presidential succession, right behind the Vice President of the United States, with an elderly president. Doesn't make him way out of the question, you know, is third in line, is getting ready perhaps to lose his job because he has found a solution, an artful solution to figure out how to get funding for NATO allies around the world, address situations on the border, do the work of the American people that go against the hardline right, and his own party is the one that's going to throw him out. And the Democrats look like they're just going to sit with their hands folded, let them throw him out and deal with the chaos later, because come November, they can say, look what the Republicans have done. They can't even run the thing themselves. You need to elect Democrats.
I don't dispute that scene. That is what we're seeing unfold. I think, though, the geopolitical realities and the sense of the importance of this legislation, both in what we're seeing around the world as well at our border, has members of Congress perhaps thinking, how can we actually save this speaker? Even if we don't like him, how can we save this speaker? And how can we actually get, as you say, this business done. And I think it's something we've talked about on this show, where we talk about politics, we talk about these politicians, and I've tried, though, many times to remind your listeners that once we get past the 40 or 60 members of Congress we always see on television, there are about another 370 who actually want to get blank done. And they are at a point now where they've reached the breaking point. And I think that's why I'm hearing a lot more about, if there is a clean vote, and now we see the White House supporting these aid bills, clean votes on Ukraine and Israel, that Democrats would protect Mike Johnson if there is a vote. We also see now,
Will they protect his speakership? Will they vote? Will they cross the lines to keep him in his seat if they try and throw him out?
I think they would if they had to, but I also hear that they are trying to perhaps head this off. That in passing the rule for this legislation, and we're going to get in the weeds here, in the House you have to pass two bills to pass a bill. One, the rule. The second, the bill.
Yes.
The rule sets the terms of the debate. And in this rule, there is talk that they would raise the threshold of the motion to vacate somehow.
Thank God.
That they would secure the speakership for the rest of this Congress in some way and buttress it. Now, I don't know. This is very much being negotiated this morning. Some of this is broken in Washington press as we speak in the past few hours. So this is, in the podcast parlance, developing. But they're trying to, I think, somehow take Chekhov's gun off the wall.
Suggesting, though, still, that is, Washington is indeed getting blank done, and it looks like blank getting it done, that you think, I'm hearing you say, you think Johnson's going to keep his job. I can't imagine it. I would be thrilled if you're right. But boy, I don't hear anybody else suggesting the odds are any way tilted for that to happen. Why are you the...
The final outcome is he ends up the most unluckiest person in Washington because he does get the bills passed, but then he gets vacated because the Democrats on the other side say, oops, well, you know, that's politics. But
I think that's the likely scenario. I think that's the likely scenario because the Democrats will benefit so much come election time by just because they don't have anybody else to put in a speaker who can get the votes, who can satisfy everybody. And then the Republicans are now responsible for taking Congress.
That's fair. And that could be the politics. Drain. There's still, once we get past the geopolitical stuff, there's still some other stuff that needs to get done before the end of the year. So it'll be, you know, deal making or not, there still will be things that need to be on the agenda. So there's the politics of this. I think, you know, Johnson saves his speakership. What we're talking about, though, for your listeners are, I think, the various paths that we have unfolding before us.
Okay. So around the world very quickly. Hang on. Before we go around the world, let's talk about the Trump trial in New York. Does this matter?
Look, I think it matters seeing, one, just the historical import of a former president sitting behind the dock in a courtroom. However, the weakness of this case, the perception of it, does merely embolden his supporters, if anything else. I think, though, the longer this goes on, I'm frankly unsure of how this unfolds because I see two ways happening. One, the images of him in the courtroom continue to remind us of what he faces, the complications, what a presidency with him could be like. On the other hand, it keeps him off the campaign trail. And I don't know which way that cuts, because sometimes on the campaign trail, he's whipping up his supporters. On the other hand, sometimes the best Biden commercial is to just let Donald Trump speak.
Well, and sometimes the best Trump commercial is just to let Joe Biden speak. I mean, they've got that.
Exactly.
Common.
Vice versa is just as true.
Okay, so for all of the Stormy Daniels conversations, I read this week that this affair was taking place while the First Lady, former First Lady, was pregnant at the time with Barron Trump. So Melania Trump is the president's, is President Trump's third wife? Is that correct?
Correct.
The third wife. And So here's an affair with a porn star actress during the time when his wife is pregnant with now his youngest son, who's in getting ready to graduate high school. That can't really play well with the far right, can it? I mean, and
well, don't play well. Which far right are we talking? Which flavor of far right are we talking about?
The, well,
the religious right.
The religious right that has supported the president. How do they stay loyal in the face of that? And if that's going to be in the headlines,
I think the religious right is an area that's going to be interesting to follow based on how he's softened somewhat his ever-changing position on abortion, as well as the split you've seen between him and the former Vice President Mike Pence. That said, many religious conservatives long ago entered into a Faustian bargain, as it were, that Donald Trump, and this language has been well described in an excellent book by Tim Alberta, the correspondent about the evangelical movement in America, that people see Donald Trump as a sinful warrior. I think the biblical comparison of King David, who is sinful but still God's anointed leader on earth, is the one that is cited. So they have justifications for supporting Donald Trump despite his behavior.
Yeah, I've seen memes, of course, on the internet, and I'm sure you all have too, of President Trump dressed in Jesus-like attire with the white robes and the crown of thorns and the whole thing. And it's been a little bit lost on me, frankly, but interesting nonetheless that actually has a following. So, Dan, first question back to President Trump. Does this actually have an impact? Does this scar him? Does this damage his chances for president?
It damages his chances while also reinforcing the base which he relies upon. So is it a net wash at the ballot box? I'm beginning to think so.
Net wash at the ballot box. Okay. Moving overseas.
Well, I think first of all, the Israeli situation, what we've seen, the successful defense of the system was not just Israel, but the quiet coordination with states like Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, others in the Gulf, Jordan as well, shooting down some of these. I don't believe in any sense that this was a demonstrative or putative attack by the Iranians. This was a serious missile launch, a coordinated drone and ballistic missile strike designed to overwhelm Israel's air defenses. And Israel's defenses held, but Israel is learning that its defenses held not because of the narrative they've long had of Israel standing alone, but Israel's defenses held because they were part of a defensive coalition of Europeans, Americans, and Arabs. And that really changes the calculus of thought when you think about this for Israel, given that Netanyahu and others in that government seem hell-bent on pissing off those very same allies at a time when Israel faces one of its most existential threats in a nation, you know, with Iran's ballistic missile program and a willingness to use it and to try to destroy Israel.
Can't he just rely on a greater antipathy towards Iran than there is towards Israel? So as long as he doesn't piss him off as much as the Iranians have pissed off everybody, then maybe we'll still side with him.
Yes, he can rely on that, but we get into the same calculus that has unfolded in Ukraine, is that we are shooting down $30,000 missiles with $3 million missiles.
Well, can't we get some $30,000 missiles? I mean, you know, it seems like everybody else seems to find plenty of them.
Well, the problem is that's why our missiles hit all their targets and theirs don't. But we're still, that is the cost, the defense production, the assembly lines, all of this, even if we are to support Israel, to support Ukraine, this is why, you know, when we talked about war with Iran last week, it was no, you couldn't possibly be equipped on our end to handle a crisis like that. So that'll be, as we see in Ukraine, the Russians are pushing. It's a segue, I think, in that you see the contrast between Israel having a full arsenal and support in Ukraine, where the weapons bunkers have run dry, And that's why I think it will be interesting to see how quickly we can get this money into Ukraine, because they actually do need it to prevent the Russians from having a rather successful spring offensive in the east.
Really quickly here, Dan, if you can, why is it important for all of the folks who are saying we shouldn't be spending our money in defenses in Ukraine? Why do I don't even know where Ukraine is? Why do I care about Ukraine? If Putin wants Ukraine, let him take Ukraine. Why do we care? Tell us why we care.
Well, first of all, if this isn't going to affect your moral judgment, you know, our values as Americans, we believe that countries should be free to determine their future, and that we should support those who stand on the side of freedom. The hard power fact of it, Russia is not our friend. Russia is not our ally. I look, the biggest fault we had in the Russiagate affair with the former President Trump was that it turned Russia into a political issue in this country rather than the geopolitical threat that it remains. A report has just been seen declassified that the Russians are keen on interfering in this election, and it's that they don't favor any side. We need to remember that. They don't favor one party or other in this country. They just favor chaos. They favor us fighting against each other. They want to take our own threads and pull us apart. They also, Putin, we have to understand, even if we don't think we're at war with Russia, he believes the West has been at war with Russia since 2006, 2008. He has long held this belief that the West has to be pushed back against.
Yeah.
And finally, in pure geopolitics, I'll end with this, pure might. We have shown that the United States can keep our main geopolitical adversary bogged down militarily without sending a single troop, soldier, or marine from our country into combat. We have kept one of our greatest adversaries pinned down simply by giving our material, which our own workers make with our tax dollars, to our friends to keep our enemies at bay without the single loss of an American service member.
Dan Mahaffey, that is
geopolitical success.
Fabulous. Vice Chairman of the Dr. Scholl Foundation from the Center for the Study of the President, Senior Political Analyst on the Farcast. And now you know why. Once again, we're reminded every week why we keep having him back. Thank you, Dan. Coming up, Jenny Harrington from Gilman Hill Advisors, my great friend. We were in an investment committee meeting yesterday. It was fascinating. She and a big institution. We're going to talk about what we discussed. I think it'll help you in the way you think about your portfolios. Please stay with us.
Michael Farr and the Farcast are proud to support Heroes, Inc. Heroes supports the spouses and children of law enforcement officers and firefighters who gave their lives in the line of duty to the greater Washington, D.C. community. Their singular goal is to honor the supreme sacrifice made by these individuals by caring for their families. Heroes' work begins within 24 hours of the tragic loss and continues indefinitely. We invite you to learn more about Heroes' mission at heroes.org. We hope that you will consider supporting Heroes as they endeavor to honor those who protect us. That's heroes.org. Heroes, here for you, here for good. And now, back to the Farcast and your host, Michael Farr. We appreciate you listening into the Farcast this week. And now to introduce this week's special guest, here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. Joining me now, Jenny Harrington from Gilman Hill Advisors, CNBC contributor, vice chairman of the Sibley Hospital Johns Hopkins Investment Committee, and a member of the board there. Jenny, welcome back to the Farcast.
Thank you for having me.
We're really glad you're here. Jenny, the market in the past, well, just this month of April the 18th, down 4.7% on stocks. We were due for a pullback. We've been talking with Labenthal in segment one. Is this it? And Jay and Labenthal says, well, who cares, really? This is kind of normal. It could go a little bit lower. I don't think it gets to a full correction. There's so much money on the sidelines. It seems to be a Fed disappointment rather than an economic sort of a flag. In fact, the economy's doing fine, and there's no reason to see markets pull back based on the economy. What do you think?
That's right. The hard thing is that, you know, the reason we're down now is because we're simply up too much. And the way I'm looking at it is there are these kind of fighting factors out there. So you have the two most important influences of the equity market doing really well. And the two most important influencers are corporate earnings, which are headed in the upward direction, and interest rates, which are headed in the downward direction.
Those interest rates are headed in the upward direction. We've seen that 10-year treasury go up above 4.6%. They've been going up here lately.
They are up. But the Fed is still committed to cutting interest rates. And you bring up a really good point. They are up. And they're up longer than
people expected. I thought Jay Powell said maybe the inflation isn't going where they wanted it to go. And therefore, maybe they're just going to stay on the sidelines and not do much. And in fact, they seem to have paused the sell-off in the Fed's portfolio, $8 trillion portfolio.
There still remains expectations. And who knows if at this point it's 50-50 that the first cut would come on July 31st. There's still expectations that the Fed starts to cut rates. And you're bringing up a super important nuance, which is it doesn't matter when they cut rates, right? Doesn't matter that it didn't happen in March like people expected.
Yeah, she's really right about this, folks. This is really important. Do it again.
It's not happening in June.
Yep.
Hopefully it happens. Hopefully for the equity markets, it happens in July. But the bottom line is the Fed is not going to increase interest rates. They are going to cut. The exact timing doesn't matter. The exact number of cuts doesn't matter. The direction of where we're headed with interest rates and with cuts matters. Something I've struggled with is the federal funds rate is short term and directly impacts the short term of interest rates. But if you look at correlations, almost any time period of history, the 10-year treasury does follow the federal funds rate. So I think I can make lots of arguments like, okay, there's no fiscal discipline. You know, the U.S. is losing its golden luster for foreign investors, and they're going to demand more risk. So the long end of the interest rate curve should stay higher for longer. You can argue all of that, but decades of history prove that the 10-year treasury follows the federal funds rate. And what we know is Fed isn't going to raise. They are still extremely likely to cut when is TBD, by how much is TBD, but the direction is down. And the same as we don't know how much corporate earnings are going to grow, we know that they are growing this year. So we've got directionally corporate earnings are going up, directionally interest rates are coming down, and those are the overwhelming factors. But that's really why the market did so much better in the first quarter, because the strength of that downward expectation on interest rates was deeper and stronger than it is now. Corporate earnings growth is still quite high. But then our friend Bob Pisani, Michael, I think he's using the best term, and I've really latched onto it. He says the problem is it's a complicated stew. And here's what's in that complicated stew: looming tax cut expirations, persistent inflation, divisive elections, a consumer that's quite mixed. Consumer isn't great, but the consumer hasn't cracked yet. Growing fiscal debt and no signs of improvement, oil prices, prolonged and horrible wars between Israel and Hamas and Russia and Ukraine, and rich equity valuations. So the stew is complicated. And I think that's part of the reason why we've seen this pullback. The two overwhelming factors that influence stocks in the long run are favorable for stocks, but there's a lot of complication out there.
And ladies and gentlemen, one of the things that's wonderful when I get to talk with Jenny and a few of my friends is that I can challenge them and I can argue with them. And when I have guests on, I don't know, I have to be polite. I really do. And I'm just not, you don't want to have a guest on and start really taking them to task and saying, this is it. Because you say, why is this guy having me on? And he's just going to, bust my chops and I'm never going to do that again. And Jenny and Jim Labenthal and others know that's not what I'm doing. And they will come back to me and challenge me on a lot of these same things. It's important. I think it's a much more productive dialogue. So with that, I'm still going to push back on Jenny one more time, because what she said was that the 10-year goes with with the Fed funds rates, and she is absolutely right. And I'm gonna break one of my own rules. I'm gonna break a market rule, of course, and suggest that wait a minute, we're adding $1.5 trillion to the debt every year. The debt service is going to be larger next year than the Defense Department budget. Debt service bigger than Defense Department budget. So perhaps the Fed is losing, as Jack Baroogian suggests, losing control of the long end of the curve, as is evidenced by the rise in gold over $2,400 an ounce from 1750, 17, wherever the hell it was forever. And that we're seeing that this is not your father's Oldsmobile. And the rule that I'm breaking, of course, is I'm suggesting perhaps it's different this time, which is always a kiss of death. But I delivered that there, right down the middle of the plate, as fat and slow as I can pitch it, Jenny.
No, but it's perfect. And it's something that I've struggled with so much too, because I can make some really strong arguments based on exactly what you just said, that the 10-year, that the long end of the curve won't come down. And it really, and it goes back in my mind to what we saw. Well, it's all your arguments, but also we kind of saw proof last October of the long end not coming down. Because what happened last October was the 10-year treasury ran up to 5%. And the reason it ran up to 5% was as the U.S. government almost shut down. And it was basically like U.S. bond buyers saying, you guys are ridiculous. You have no fiscal responsibility. You have no intentions of having any. Like, if we're going to lend to you, we want more money for the risk we're taking. And so I think that could support the long end of the curve. But this is where I come back to that perfect correlation, because those are so speculative. And I mean, you can look back so far, and there have been dicey, tricky situations in the past. Although I don't know that there's ever been this level of fiscal irresponsibility. I can't find a historic time period to point to that.
And you know, you look at some of these other things that are so highly correlated, like the inversion of the yield curve and the way that it correlates with various recessions and economic slowdown. We're still inverted. The yield on the 2-year treasury, ladies and gentlemen, is still 35 basis points, 0.35 of 1%. That's a big deal, believe it or not, higher than the 10-year. So you get paid more to loan the government money for 2 years, you get paid a lot more to loan the government money for 3 months and 6 months than you do for 10 years. They pay you less for money for 10 years. Normally, 10 years is a longer, riskier period. So that's just another one of the datum that is very inconsistent and has old guys like me scratching our heads going, yeah, I don't get it. This isn't supposed to happen this way. What else will happen that isn't supposed to happen this way is always kind of where I go, Jenny.
Let's actually riff off of your this time is different for a sec, because I can make a lot of arguments also that this time is different. But as an investor, then I say to myself, no, you have to look to history and presume this time isn't different. And that's where I come out with interest rates, and just kind of like I force myself, you know, to not have too many branches off of my choose your own adventure and go with history. But here's another one. I think this upcoming presidential election is going to be incredibly divisive in a way that could be damaging for the fabric of American society. And if we look at all of the historical political data, what you see is a red wave, blue wave, red administration, blue administration, purple administration. There's tons of data that shows the market doesn't really care.
Right.
And the long-term outcomes under red, blue, purple, whatever it is, they're all roughly the same. You know, like maybe a percent difference here and a percent difference there. And so I'm struggling as a portfolio manager with this too. So when I talk about the complicated stew, right, one of the things I put in that stew is divisive elections. And then I say to myself, you know, I'm really scared that this time is going to be different, and that a win by one or win by the other is going to like really have a impact on the market. But then I take myself back and look at the historical evidence and the historical studies and say, actually, there's not much difference. And I'm doing the same thing with the 10-year. I can easily make arguments for this time is different for both. I mean, you can make arguments for this time is different for anything. There have been a lot of conflicts in the Middle East in the past 20 years. Like, why is this time different? I don't know. It sure feels different to me right now. Feels like it's going to spread. It feels scary. But then I keep trying to take myself back and say, they were all ultimately resolved. They didn't derail the markets. They didn't spark, you know, something much, much bigger.
And one of the things that you'll see, ladies and gentlemen, and hear, when you begin to think that the talking heads on TV or the analysts you read in the newspapers have no idea what they're talking about, you're wrong. They really do have an idea what they're talking about. What they can't figure is how people will behave illogically, okay? When the behaviors occur that are not consistent with history, those behaviors and aberrations are typically short-term, and they do return to the long-term logic. But, you know, you do begin to question when something happens. CNBC had me on the phone, had kept me up on election night when Donald Trump won the election against Hillary Clinton for that first time. They had me on the phone at 1 a.m. and 2 a.m. and 3 a.m. And the consensus was the markets would crater over a Donald Trump election because of all of the things he proposed. And by the time markets opened, we were up 800 points on Dow futures. It was a remarkable reverse. After 9/11, and George Bush announced that we were going into Iraq and we were going to have Desert Storm and we were going to do this and we were going to do that, certainly going into a war in the Middle East and putting U.S. troops on the ground, as the president said we were going to do, which we did in February or March in 2001, markets went straight up. People sold off in expectations for very logical reasons, logical defensive reasons, where you would say, I just don't want to be there when all of this goes down. And that's not the way markets reacted. Markets saw through to something else. They saw this as a short-term nothing burger that was not going to affect how many cans of Pepsi-Cola people bought.
And life therefore, marches on.
It life does. Life marches
relentlessly on.
Thank God for all of us and for our children and grandchildren, all of those things, that it marches relentlessly on. So we can get the arguments right. You can count on us for a good, solid, cogent, rational argument. We're reasonably intelligent people. We've studied the history. We've experienced a lot of it firsthand. And we're going to give you the right argument. It just could be wrong.
Michael. There's no way to send all the listeners, maybe I'll post it on Twitter, a little picture to go along with this, is there?
Harry could put a picture on the, as he sends out the note with this, yes.
Perfect. Harry, I'm going to send you a picture. But for the listeners who don't want to do that, just go and look up, like Google or whatever, Google what your plan versus reality. And this lovely picture comes up. I saw it on Facebook years ago. And I'm going to describe it to you. Your plan is riding a bike up a nice little incline that's neither too, you know, steep nor too flat. And you just kind of head upwards in a nice, smooth direction. And then reality, your plan versus reality. Reality shows that you're still ending up in the same spot. You're still headed in the upward direction. But along the way, there's a storm. There's a flood. There's all sorts of stuff. So when we talk about interest rates staying higher, you know, or not, when we talk about elections actually skewing the market or not, here's what I think. I think, and this is what I concluded for my client call that I'm doing today. Where do we come out of all this? Same outcome as always, headed in the upward direction. The thing that changes every time are the snafus. So this time we've got the geopolitical turmoil, we've got inflation, we've got potential tax increases at the end of 2025. There's always different snafus, but the trajectory and the path is always the same. It just so
tell Fred and Ethel what to do, Jenny. Tell Fred and Ethel what to do.
Instead of telling them what to do. Yes, no, that's what to do. Just stick with it. But we always know that. I was thinking what to tell Fred and Ethel, but we tell them the same thing every time. Stick with it. Listen to Michael Farr. Okay, but I have something different to tell Fred and Ethel this time that I've really been thinking about. For every one of your golf buddy's fantastic investments that she brags about, please know that in the background, there are 6 to 10 either disasters or totally lackluster investments that they will never be mentioned in your company. So just know that for all the wonderful investments, nobody ever mentions the bad ones. Oh, hold on. Unless you're a professional portfolio manager, in which case your clients only talk about the bad ones.
That's
and
exactly
fail
right.
To recognize the good ones.
Or my
so it's
brother.
More insight for Fred and Ethel this time versus advice.
Yeah, my brother-in-law. He's never made a bad investment. Never.
Exactly.
And I'm an idiot, by the way.
I was thinking about this because I was doing quarterly reviews, and I have a client who has a huge Tesla position. And for years, I think I was on the cusp of getting fired because clearly I was a, you know, dummy who didn't own Tesla and he was a genius. And guess what's completely evaporated from the conversation over the past 2 years?
That it's funny. No, we did. No, that's not that's nothing that that I don't ever remember saying that you get that one too. Jenny Harrington is CEO of Gilman Hill Advisors, CNBC contributor. One of the smartest people you're going to want to ever talk to on Wall Street, and my great friend. Jenny, thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael.
That's it for another Farcast, ladies and gentlemen. We're so grateful that you join us each and every week. And we've added thousands, actually, of new listeners and Farcast subscribers. We're so grateful to each of you. Welcome to the Farcast. We really do mean that every week when we say it. We'll be back next week as we cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world. For everybody at Hightower and Farr Miller in Washington, thanks so much. Have a great weekend. I'm Michael Farr.
Thanks for joining us on another episode of The Farcast. We hope you enjoy the show as much as we enjoy making it for you. Thanks to our guests this week, Jim Labenthal, Dan Mahaffey, and special guest, Jenny Harrington. The Farcast is produced by Michael Farr and Harry Jennings and comes to you weekly for free on all major podcast platforms, including TuneIn, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. You can stream past episodes as well as subscribe so you never miss a new show. Please be aware that anytime we or any of our guests mention a specific company, sector, or refer to performance in relation to an earnings report, news headline, or economic trend, it's not a recommendation to buy or sell. Review the risks and rewards of any investment with your financial advisor for what specific investment and general strategy is appropriate for you before you make any investment decision. And as always, if we can be of assistance at Farr Miller in Washington, please reach out to me at hjennings@farrmiller.com. We are here to help, and I'm happy to arrange for any of our listeners an appointment with one of our financial professionals to review your portfolio, your needs, and your goals. We love reading all of your notes and try to reply to as many as we can. You can reach us at hjennings@farrmiller.com. Let us know any questions you have about past episodes or questions you'd like us to answer in upcoming shows. Please subscribe and share the show. We'll be back with you next week. Our schedule in coming weeks includes special guests Liz Young from SoFi and Dr. Jay Bryson, Chief Economist from Wells Fargo. Take care, stay safe, and stay healthy. And thanks for listening to the Farcast. Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Farr Miller in Washington is a group comprised of investment professionals registered with Hightower Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Some investment professionals may also be registered with Hightower Securities, LLC, member FINRA and SIPC. Advisory services are offered through Hightower Advisors, LLC. Securities are offered through Hightower Securities, LLC. All information referenced herein is from sources believed to be reliable. Farr Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC have not independently verified the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Farr Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC and any of its affiliates make no representations or warranties, expressed or implied, as to the accuracy or completeness of the information or for statements or errors or omissions or results obtained from the use of this information. Farr Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC and any of its affiliates assume no liability or any action made or taken in reliance on or relating in any way to the information. This podcast and the materials contained herein were created for informational purposes only. The opinions expressed are solely those of the authors and do not represent those of Hightower Advisors, LLC or any of its affiliates. Farr Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC or any of its affiliates do not provide tax or legal advice. This material was not intended or written to be used or presented in any way to any entity as tax or legal advice. Clients are urged to consult their tax and/or legal advisors for related questions.